You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Interstate Batteries offers a wide variety of batteries for your everyday needs. Stop into one of their thousands of retail locations and talk with a battery specialist about batteries for your truck, trail cameras, and even those weird batteries for your rangefinder. Interstate Batteries even offers cell phone repair in certain locations. For more information, visit interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
This episode is brought to you by Peloton. Break through the busiest time of year with the brand new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus. Powered by Peloton IQ. With real-time guidance and endless ways to move, you can personalize your workouts and train with confidence. Helping you reach your goals in less time. Let yourself run, lift, sculpt, push, and go. Explore the new Peloton Cross Training Tread Plus at onepeloton.com.
President's Day savings are happening now at the Home Depot with up to 40% off select appliances. Looking to upgrade your fridge? Check out LG's newest model, serving up ice in all kinds of styles. Cube, crushed, craft ice, and now new mini craft ice straight from the dispenser. From cold brew to fizzy favorites, these refrigerators will have you entertaining like a pro. Shop President's Day savings and get up to 40% off, plus free delivery on select appliances like LG at the Home Depot. Free delivery on appliance purchases of $1,498 or more. Offer valid February 5th through the 25th, U.S. only. See store online for details.
Welcome to the Nine Finger Chronicles Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and I can't believe that 2024 marks 10 years of podcasting. Over the last decade, I have had the pleasure of talking with hundreds upon hundreds of passionate outdoors men and women who share the same excitement for hunting as I do. Whether you hunt public lands or private property, shoot traditional archery equipment or high-powered rifles, we all have one thing in common, and that's our love for the great outdoors. This year, I plan on continuing that tradition and bringing educational and entertaining content to your ears. Thank you for your continued support, and I hope you all have the best seasons of your life. Good vibes in, good vibes out. Mic check, 1, 2. Ladies and gentlemen, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever you're listening to this from a very snowy Iowa. I'm sitting here in my office and I think we've had maybe 8 inches and they're predicting another 3 inches maybe. So, but it's starting to snow or the wind's starting to pick up and it doesn't look like it's going to be, just stack up. I think it's going to start to drift. That's going to make travel a little crazy. Now I have to, give a little public service announcement here. I bought a muzzleloader, right? Everybody knows that. I went to go sight it in the other day, and I needed to go ahead and do a little bit more work sighting it in. Now, here's the thing. I'm not going to be able to go late season hunting this year. I believe tomorrow is the 10th, and that is the last day of late season, the last day of the season for Iowa. And unfortunately, due to the family schedule, I would also probably say my lack of being prepared. I didn't really put it on the calendar, but we've got family. We had family events. We had Christmases. We had New Year's Eve events. We got wrestling tournaments. Like, so life just kind of got away, and I prioritized family over hunting. And so I had an MRI. Let's see, this is going to be released on a Wednesday. So I had an MRI on Monday. My shoulder hurts like a SOB. And so I want to know if I have a torn ligament in my shoulder. It hurts every day. And I think if you follow me on social, you will see that. Now, my goal is to be a bow hunter, right? And so I wanted to take care of this early on in this year. If I do need to have surgery, then I want to make sure that I get it done early enough to where I can rehab it and start shooting my bow again in a handful of months, start working on my strength, start getting everything, you know, back to normal before, I would say, June, July. Based off of all the stuff that I've read, it takes like a full 6 months to fully rehab, and then you have to start strength, your strength exercises again. And so the whole goal is for me to get back into compound bow, 70 pounds. I might have to drop down for a little bit in order to get, you know, to start shooting and then build that strength up until I can get back to 70. I'm confident in that if that's the road that happens. And then I'm guessing I'm going to need some kind of physical therapy after the surgery. But that's what is on my mind right now. That's kind of what's on my schedule. And unfortunately, the late season just did not happen for me. I'm bummed, but at the same time, that's life, man. All right, today, on today's episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles, we are going to talk with Aaron Warbritton. You guys know who he is, the hunting public, and we're going to talk about the direction hunting is going in North America. We talk about access. We talk about rules and regulations. We talk about hunting culture. We talk about gear like cellular trail cameras, crossbows, things like that. And the overall direction and whether we think it is good or bad, the direction that hunting is going here in North America. And I had an absolute blast talking with him. His thoughts are very well calculated. It's a great conversation, almost an excellent conversation, I would say. And so I would definitely recommend sharing this episode with any friends or family members who might also be interested in the hunting community, the hunting culture in North America, so forth and so on. So before I do get into today's episode, though, we're going to do a quick commercial block. If you're looking for a saddle or to jump into the saddle game, go check out Tethered's saddles. They have saddle hunting accessories, saddles, platforms, everything you need to hop on that saddle hunting train. And I must say, it is worth it. So go read up on tetherednation.com. WaspArchery.com, discount code NFC20. I know that the seasons are winding down, but it's never too early to get prepared for the next season. Go check out Wasp's lineup of fixed and mechanical broadheads, WaspArchery.com, VortexOptics.com. If you want the, in my opinion, best binocular or optic for hunting, you need to go check out VortexOptics.com. They have binoculars, spotting scopes, range finders, red dots, rifle scopes, anything really, then they have it for you. VortexOptics.com, and go check out Vortex's apparel line as well. Code Blue Sense, man, I've had nothing, you know, that Code Blue rope-a-dope system that I used all fall, man, I'm very happy with the results of that. I put a trail camera over this rope-a-dope mock scrape type setup, and I had a lot of deer come and visit that rope-a-dope, and so that allowed me to get an inventory of all of the deer that are on this property and or all the properties that I hunt, and so I'm very happy with that. Other than that, if you are interested in any type of scent elimination sprays, synthetic in real deer scents, go check out codebluescents.com. I do have a discount code, NFC20, and that is going to allow you to get 20% off, NFC20. The Woodman's Pal, man, I'll tell you this, man, I've used the crap out of that thing. It is a machete. It's what they call a habitat tool. Hacking trees, hacking shooting lanes, hacking trail camera locations, clearing out access routes, even stuff around the house or the farm or the hunting property. Go check out woodmanspal.com. It is a made in America product, and they've been around since the 40s. So these guys are legit. So woodmanspal.com. Last but not least, Huntworth. I know that and I said this before, but I know that the seasons are winding down for many of us. Okay. And sometimes, you know, even some places in, we're sitting here in January, southern states are peak rut right now. And so, again, there's no early, it's not early enough to get prepared for the next. It's never too early, I guess that's what I want to say, to be prepared for the upcoming season. Go to Huntworth's website. Take a look at all of the options that these guys, I'm a huge fan of their products, and for more than just the product itself, but the price point. Like, I would put their stuff up against some of the most elite brands of hunting apparel on the market, hunting camo or whatever you want to call it, hunting gear on the market. I'd put Huntworth up against that. Their heat boost technology that they have, it really does keep you warm when it's cold outside, and it keeps you cool when it's hot, right? And so they have an entire lineup, and in my opinion, along with the elite brands, they have some of the best layering systems at a more affordable cost. So go check out Huntworth, and they're usually running discount codes almost all the time. And so go to their social pages and take advantage of some of the discounts that they're coming with. So, all right, commercials are done. Do me a huge favor. Go to iTunes, go to Spotify, wherever you download the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast or listen to any of the Sportsman's Empire podcast network. Please go leave a 5-star review. Let everybody know that this is a badass podcast. And it's worth something, right? Whether that's for entertainment purposes, whether that's for educational purposes. Thank you very much for that. Please go out and support the companies that support this podcast. And last but not least, man, we got to have good vibes, right? So let's get into today's episode with Aaron Warbritton of The Hunting Public. 3, 2, 1. All right, welcome to the next episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and today I am joined by Mr. Aaron Warbritton. Aaron, man, how you doing?
Doing well, buddy.
Hey.
Just surviving winter.
Yeah, I hear that. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I love this video you put out. I believe it's of your stepson shooting. Was this his first deer ever?
Yeah.
Okay. And how hyped both of you got after that went down. I was like, I watched that video online and I almost was like, I could have flipped over a car. I was so jacked at that moment. Just like, because that is that's the realest, rawest emotion that hunters have. And especially when it's a kid who you obviously love and support in his hunting journey, and just that amount of emotion, dude, it got me fired up.
Yeah, man, it'll be hard for me to top that one.
Yeah,
that was pretty wild, and there was a lot that went into that. You know, it wasn't. You see, sometimes these youth hunts or a mentor and mentee hunt, if you will, when they take somebody out and they put them in a blind and they shoot an animal like within the first hour or so. Yeah. And you don't always see that reaction, but the recipe just came together for us because he had went multiple times with me over the years bow hunting, and then has turkey hunted with me several times, just, you know, tagging along, not packing a weapon or anything. And then when he finally had a chance to harvest his first deer this fall, it took like several times before we got one. Mm-hmm. You know, and he actually missed a doe earlier in the fall and was like, he was upset, but he was like ready to go.
Yeah.
So walking all the way back to the truck that night, he's like, I'm going to practice when I get home, and we're going to shoot at the box before I go to school every day this next week. And the next time we get to go, I'm going to drop him.
Yeah.
And like, he was just fired up, man.
Yeah.
So it all just came together at that point where we had both put in some work up to that point to get that deer. And then when he got him, it was like, we were just going to be happy with a doe, spike. It didn't matter. I mean, he was ready to shoot whatever. And then this nice buck comes along and we just lost it.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. And I'll say this, as a parent, I found
that doing things a little bit harder, throwing kids into scenarios where they're not successful immediately, and that, like, the hand-holding portion of it, kind of, it's gone. It's on them. They experience some failure. It makes those times where you are successful that much sweeter. And I always wonder if kids who have been set up on deer, you know, for youth season, like on a food plot, and you know deer's coming out and you know they're going to get a shot, what the retention is of that type of hunting versus the style where you have to go out and just earn it.
Yeah, I'm assuming that it's not good.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to rewire my brain completely whenever I go with him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure you're the same way. You know, we've been doing this so long at this point, guys like you and I, that we take hunting pretty seriously when we go out there, you know, from our gear to, you know, the conditions, even the animals we decide to shoot or whatever. So I got to rewire my brain completely when I'm going with him.
Right.
And I had a great mentor in my dad that took me when I was a kid. And lots of people do have great mentors when they were kids, but my dad was like, he was the perfect one because he is not a good hunter at all. And he does not take it seriously. Like when I was a kid, he would take me whenever I wanted to go. We would go until I got bored, and he was usually getting bored about the same time. And then we'd go to town and get donuts.
Yeah.
And we did that over and over and over again and didn't have success for sometimes even years before we finally got some. Like, I eventually killed my first turkey, and then 4 or 5 years later, I called in his first turkey for him.
Oh, wow.
But because I wanted to go, he would take me.
Yeah.
So we were both almost learning as we went. And I try to put myself back in that mindset whenever I'm taking miles. So I'm just worried about the safety aspect and – you know, I'll give him options like, okay, we can set up over here, or we can go over here, or we can set on the ground over here, or we can just still hunt through the woods. I'm kind of like, what do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And then he'll kind of tell me a little bit, and we'll talk a little bit, and then I will let him basically decide on what he wants to do.
Right.
Like where he wants to sit, all that.
Right.
And then I'm just concerned about the safety aspect and trying to help him, you know, get a good shot in an animal.
Right. This is, I'm glad you brought that up because I had to rewire my brain when I started taking my daughter out, turkey hunting. And I was just like, you gotta stop moving. Cause I was brought up turkey hunting where it was trial by fire. Like you got up against a tree, you sat still. If you moved, tough shit, off to the next bird. Right. And so I was trying to take what I've learned about turkey hunting and force it down a kid's throat, like in the first time they've ever gone hunting, right? And I was trying to educate him so fast. And I think what ultimately happened is there, I instead of having a really fun, good experience, it was almost like stimulus overload for her. There was just so much information coming at her at one time. She just kind of shut off, and I'm guessing she didn't enjoy it as much. But the second time we went out, it was more way laid back because I witnessed my own errors, and so I was just laid back. Hey, what do you think we should do? The turkeys are gobbling over here. Maybe we should go over here and kind of guide them through questioning of what they want to do. And so we got really close this past season, and that closeness and that struggle, I think, is motivating her for this upcoming season.
Yep. Same with Miles, because he didn't kill a turkey last spring.
Yeah.
And we did really good on the first two hunts. We got in position, and we were hunting my family farm. Like, we kill turkeys in a 20x40 spot up there, just like a machine anymore.
Yeah.
It wasn't like that when I was a kid, but after hunting there for, you know, my whole life at this point, we know where to go and sit. And I could have took him up there, got him set up before daylight, been set up underneath the roosted bird and set up a decoy, and he probably could have shot one immediately. But instead, we waited for like 30 minutes after daylight. The birds are on the ground. They're already headed to that spot, so we had to kind of sneak up there. You know, we just did we didn't do it my way.
Right.
We did it kind of his way and at right. his pace. But I did exactly what you're saying on the third hunt of our spring, where we'd been several times, and he had the safety off multiple times on gobblers, and then we got really close and had one drumming just out of sight. And he was getting fidgety, and, mm-hmm. you know, he was getting uncomfortable. I mean, you know how it is. When you got a bird there and, you know, both legs are asleep and mm-hmm. your neck's cramped up and, mm-hmm. you know, your back hurts, you just got to sit there and wait. Well, I was doing the same thing you're talking about. I was like, Miles, you cannot move. They'll see you. Mm-hmm. You just got to be patient. And I didn't realize, like, he's super uncomfortable. He can't see the bird. He can't even hear the drumming
right.
like I can. And he doesn't know what's going on, and he yeah. doesn't like this.
Yeah.
So eventually I ended up sneaking up there and shooting the turkey, and he was thrilled with that. But I was looking at my options. I was like, well, I can either make him sit here for another 45 minutes and be really uncomfortable and maybe get a shot, or we can just crawl up there and spook or kill the thing right now.
Right, right. Yeah.
And that's what we ended up doing, and he liked that outcome way better. But yeah. I fell into the same trap.
Yeah.
Because I'm the same way. I'm an intense guy sometimes when it comes to hunting. I'm like, Miles, you can't move. You know, you got to keep your gun on your knee. And he was yeah. taking it down and putting it in his lap. And he wasn't liking that. But.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this. Like, you know, I've been hunting since I was 14 years old. And I'll turn 44. That's like 30-some years of hunting for myself.
Yeah.
And so I have to remember it took me 30 years to gain all this knowledge about wildlife. And I cannot expect my children to pick that up in one season.
Right.
Yeah. So, man, that's awesome that, that you have brought the fire to those kids and it sounds like they're in it now. They want to be a part of the lifestyle.
Oh yeah. Anything hunting and fishing, and we're going.
Yep.
Like that's my main priority anymore over getting stuff myself.
Yeah.
Is if we have the boys and they want to hunt or fish, then that's what we're going to do.
Right. So, man, there's so many things we could unpack out of that started that conversation, but you know, we're two guys. We are involved not only in the hunting community, but in the hunting industry. And I want to get your take. And this is going to be a very broad, vague question. And so I'll just ask it. And that is the direction of hunting in North America. We'll just have it broad. Are we going in the right direction with hunting in North America?
Man, honestly, I don't really think so, broadly.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of problems. I mean, we've been talking about some positive things here mm-hmm. with taking our kids, and that's been the most rewarding thing that maybe I've ever done in hunting.
Right.
And I do see some hope on the horizon and things going on that are positive, but overall, no, I don't. I think about 30-ish years ago, maybe a little bit longer than that, we kind of started down the wrong path, if you will. And at that time, it would have been impossible for anybody to know.
Right.
But now we are seeing the effects of that long term.
Mm-hmm.
And none of it really, I don't know that any of it's getting better or worse. I mean, we try to have these conversations and come up with solutions and try to put out content that helps and whatnot here and there. But yeah, I hate to be a Debbie Downer, but it's right. not looking too good.
Be a little
unless
specific.
We make some pretty serious changes.
Yeah. Be specific on some of the things that concern you.
I think overall trophy hunting is a problem in the way that we've done it. Now, I say all that because I love hunting mature bucks.
Yeah.
And you're the same way.
Yep.
I mean, we've been doing this our whole life, and I love going out there and trying to figure these things out. Like, that's one of the funnest parts of deer hunting for me.
Right.
Aside from taking the kids or mentoring somebody is figuring out how a mature buck uses the landscape and how they move and all that stuff. Like, it's so interesting to me.
Right.
But trophy hunting in general has created a market around it, around, you know, I guess residential hunting land and all sorts of things that has, man, it's not led us to a good place, because the majority of the people in North America approve of hunting for food.
Right.
But the majority of them, like 70 some percent, don't necessarily agree with trophy hunting. Maybe there's a way that we can balance the two. I'm hopeful that there is, because like I said, I enjoy essentially trophy hunting. I like hunting mature bucks.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, our predecessors hunted more for food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is just a couple hundred years ago. We're not talking thousands of years ago. This is just a couple hundred years ago that they hunted for food. And it was always a sort of a social thing. Like tribes did it together. They had hunting parties and whatnot. And then, you know, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, you had deer camp culture.
Yep.
You had folks that were hunting for big bucks, but most of the time it was a group of people getting together for the social aspect of deer camp and going out there to have a positive experience in the woods. And there was no talk about inches. There was no talk about deer score. There was very little talk about, you know, managing for mature bucks.
Yeah.
Now, granted, some of the land management stuff has been positive. Like I look at some big land managers that their goal is to harvest mature bucks, and they have done some great things with wildlife habitat on their property.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a positive thing that's come out of this that I didn't used to see. But as time has went on, I realized, like, wow, if you have a lot of private land and you've got the drive and the motivation to improve the wildlife habitat on that property, you have a lot of control over that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do things that are positive for the next generation and so on and so forth. So I think that's a good thing. The problem is, to grow a mature buck on a piece of ground, you need other things other than habitat improvement, and that is lack of access, lack of human intrusion.
Mm-hmm.
What ends up happening there is they're just, if everybody becomes a trophy hunter, there's not enough big bucks to satisfy everybody. There is enough deer in general.
Right.
Like, we have a decent deer population, but if everybody decides they're going to be a trophy hunter and shoot 5-6-year-old bucks, then you end up with these scenarios where you got 5 or 6 guys with trail camera pictures of the same big buck, and all 5 or 6 of those guys are hunting 5 or 6 different properties, and they're all hunting for that particular deer. One person's going to maybe harvest it. You know, and in order to get that deer on your property, you really need not be there very much.
Right.
And the more property you have, the higher your odds of keeping that deer on that property where you can kill it.
Right.
So where does that lead? That, I know I'm kind of going down the rabbit hole here, but
no,
that essentially leads to less access.
So it's almost like, if we're going to do an equation here, it would be the number of acres a single hunter requires is larger than what it used to be.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. And it used to be universally more spread out across the landscape.
Right.
So you would take a county, per se, back in the days when permission was easy to get, and when people weren't focused on that thing that we've just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
They were just focused on having a positive experience and seeing some deer. Well, then you put 1,000 people in a county, and they're evenly distributed all over the place. Everybody has positive experiences.
Right.
Their goals and their expectations are lower than they are now. And they ultimately had more ground to run around on and share with one another. Now you look at that 1,000 people in that county, and there's one 600-acre public area in the corner of it. That's where the majority of the people are hunting, because they don't have access to the rest of it like they used to.
Right.
It's either it's a money game.
Yep.
You've got to have money to acquire access via leasing or buying. And because of that, most farmers are not going to give you permission.
Yeah.
Or most landowners are not going to give you permission. that dries up over time, and then where do people have to go?
Yeah, that is a absolute huge concern, because I always ask the question to myself, would we be in this state or would we have this problem right now if whitetail bucks only grew to 120 inches? They all have the same rack. Yeah.
Well, it wouldn't be to that extent, I wouldn't say.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But there's other things too. It's not just one thing.
Yeah.
I don't want to sound like I'm harping on, you know, the trophy hunters, and like I said, I am one to a degree.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there's always a bit of like myself being a hypocrite when I talk about some of these problems, because I do the same thing that I'm kind of complaining about as far as the future of hunting is concerned. And so it's just this ever evolving opinion that I have of what is right and what is wrong for the future of hunting.
Yep. It's same here. I mean, I think there might be a way that we can have our cake and eat it too, to a degree,
mm-hmm.
but it's going to require everybody to share more. It's going to require, you know, I mean, say you've been doing this for 40 years and you've been saving money your whole life to acquire hunting ground, and you've earned that
mm-hmm.
and you've got, you know, 6 or 7 properties that total 5,000 acres, for example.
Yeah.
It's like, I know that you've spent that time to earn that money and earn that land to some degree, but you also got to remember they print more money every day. Mm-hmm. Land is not the same commodity. It's not comparable. There is only so much of it. There's a finite amount.
Yep.
And humans, especially in your lifetime, I mean, we're all born and gonna die. So the people that are close to that land right now either have the opportunity to use it now or never.
Yeah.
So if you can find a way to share more with folks and involve them with what's going on, I think that would be better off for all of us.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing for people to swallow, you know, because I hear that argument. It's like, well, you know, I worked my whole life to buy this property, and mm-hmm. I totally understand and hear where that's coming from. But you know, there's also people that are nearby that could use a place to go shoot a squirrel.
Yep.
Or that could use, you know, a doe or two in the freezer in the winter.
Yeah.
Like, maybe try to open your doors a little bit to that.
Yeah.
You don't have to let 20 guys go in there and run every buck off your property. But, you know, if everybody gave a little bit there, then that would help in the long run, I think.
Yeah. Man, it's like I just had this thought pop into my head, and like this big buck hunting, you can call it a craze, but it's the way it is now, right? It's not necessarily a craze anymore. It's just life. Everybody is chasing the biggest deer, and it's almost like we can see that we're going down some kind of a wrong path, right? But I don't think anybody cares about it. Anybody cares. It's like a drug addict, right? It's just like, I need this next drug, aka this next big buck, and I'm wearing blinders. I don't know what's going on. I don't care what's going around me, as long as I get that fix every single year.
Yeah, dude. I mean, people work their whole year
mm-hmm.
just to get vacation time to go and do this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they go through the stresses and rigors of life. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, I finally got my chance to go and do what I love to do. I'm going to do it. And I don't want to sacrifice any of that, because I've already sacrificed so much of my time doing other things just to get to this point. Like, it's a freaking hard problem to solve.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
so as that acreage per hunter, let's say, goes up, and then what we see is a displacement. So
this time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American.
Let's just, for example, and I've beat this horse to death talking about this, but I feel like it needs to be discussed all the time. And that is, I live in Southern Iowa. Okay. I've hunted my whole life in Southern Iowa. And so what I've seen here is either non-resident landowners come in to this big buck country and they purchase the property, and, or they have, it doesn't even have to be a non-resident, but oftentimes what happens is if there's a property with good deer habitat, someone will move in and they will kick everybody else out. Right.
Yep.
And so now we have this hunter displacement. And where do the hunters go? They try to go anyway, especially in Iowa with limited resources for public ground. They try to go to public ground. And so you're more experienced in this next question. And that is, as your time spent on, you know, all these years you've spent on public ground hunting, have you noticed an uptick in people hunting public ground?
The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. You can't get just one. Okay, so that's not like some marketing hyperbole. You literally can't get just one. They come in twos. So like, if you want just one, you're going to need to find a friend who loves slow-roasted chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch sauce. Or a friend of a friend, or have an awkward conversation with a complete stranger to see if they're obsessed with chicken, bacon, and avocado ranch. Or you could just like eat them both because you're obsessed with slow-roasted chicken, bacon. Okay, you get the idea. The new Chicken Bacon Ranch Street Chalupa is a Taco Bell. Participating Taco Bell U.S. locations for limited time while supplies last.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
Oh, yeah, but it just depends on where you're at.
Right.
You know, in Iowa, definitely, because like you said, it's really limited. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of public land in Iowa. Like, there are giant swaths of the state with nothing,
right,
with no open access public.
Yep.
So
counties,
you
entire
know,
counties.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So you get people traveling from across the state to go and hunt there. And whenever I see them, I mean, it's in Iowa, I don't see it as like a, it hasn't had a tremendous negative impact on our hunting success out there. We haven't seen that really change a whole lot over the last few years, but we also don't have, I'd say our group and our criteria for success is high, but not as high as it goes.
Right.
You know, we're happy with a nice 3 or 4 year old buck, mm-hmm, if we get a chance at one. And, you know, there's some folks that want to shoot nothing but a 5 year old buck or older, and they've got higher criteria. And for them, things may have changed a little bit.
Right.
But I definitely have seen more people in Iowa. I've seen more resident hunters,
yeah,
in Iowa. And I think the non-resident number of hunters is always capped. And
yeah,
in Iowa, but I think more of them drawing tags now are going to public than they than there used to be.
Right.
I think they used to go to private more, but I mean, the reason why we started hunting public up there was because we couldn't find a place to hunt.
Yeah.
I was making 20 grand a year and trying to pay my rent, and I didn't have no money to lease a property, let alone buy a property.
Right.
I was that first year I was in Iowa, I actually finally got permission to hunt 2.5 hours from my house. And I was driving back and forth down there, and then I realized, like, I actually was fortunate enough to have a piece of public like 15 minutes away.
Right.
So I started going over there and hunting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was just easier and more convenient for me because the access was there. But I know a lot of people don't have that.
Yeah.
But yeah, sorry, it took me a while to answer your question. But yes, definitely seen more, especially resident hunters in Iowa.
Yeah.
And they all say the same thing.
Yeah.
Like when you get to talking to them about it, it's like all of them. I used to think it was just my story coming from Northeast Missouri.
Yeah.
Because when I was a kid, I had access to hunt thousands and thousands of acres of private across a bunch of different landowners. And a lot of other local people in the community had access to hunt that same property. You know, it was just a farmer, a farming family that would allow a lot of different people to hunt, as long as you took care of their property and worked together and didn't cause any problems. And it just, yeah, it was all good. And that slowly started drying up as I was going through high school and college. And then by the time I got out of college, there was very little. You know, this basically happened over a 15-year period, if you will.
Are you talking
about... And I thought that was...
Are you talking about land sales? Like the landowner passed away or they decided to sell the farm and then it went to, it changed hands and therefore you weren't able to hunt it?
Basically all of it, but yes.
Okay.
To chalk it up, it was the increased market for recreational hunting land.
Got
whether
it.
That's leasing or buying or whatever. All of a sudden we started seeing people from the city coming up and buying, small farms and properties that were held by local families for, generations. And the farming became, a multi-layered issue.
Right.
It's not just the
right.
trophy hunting thing. It's like, think about the farming practices in the last 40 years.
Right.
40 years ago, you could go down the road, at least where I'm from in rural Northeast Missouri, you'd go down the road and you'd see small farm after small farm after small farm. Like, this guy's got 100 acres. He's got some pigs. He's got some cows. He's doing 80 acres of row crop. And they're able to make it work. He's
got
a side job here or there. Nowadays, if you don't have 1,500, 2,000 acres there to row crop farm, most people are not doing it.
Right.
And there's no small livestock operation like there was then. It's all big operations.
Right.
So that, that in itself displaces a lot of people. Because then you, like you said, your average hunter per acres, basically, that's gone up.
Yep.
Well, it's the same thing with farming. Like your average farmer's farming way more.
Oh yeah.
Now
that's an issue.
Used to.
That's a big issue. Like you said, my grandpa, I believe in the peak of his row crop years, he owned 160 acres and he leased another 80. Okay. And so 240 of acreage of tillable and he had some hogs and he made,
yep.
And I mean, some hogs, I mean, probably 20. That's it.
Yep.
And he made that work his entire life. And now, so nobody's taken that over for my family, right? It's been cash rented now. So it's now going to somebody else. And typically what happens is and I'll just use this as the example, a non-resident buys a farm. He's going to try to find the biggest farmer in the area to cash rent his crop because he's not going to take the time to go in and be like, hey, are there any locals that need extra ground that would like to cash rent this? Usually it's a big farmer who's already, potentially farming 10,000 acres coming. Yep. I'll pick it up. I'll pick it up. And so then there's not only the displacement of hunters, but there's displacement of all people who use the land, including farmers.
Yep.
So,
Yeah, and that's bigger than the farmers. Yeah. You know, that gets into the political things global geopolitical politics, basically us feeding the world versus feeding our local communities. Mm-hmm. Like, this is extremely complex.
Yeah.
And there's no like, I mean, I know I'm kind of talking crap on trophy hunting a minute ago, but it's not like, okay, if we take away trophy hunting, that solves all the problems. Like, no, not at all. Like, this is a very complex issue.
Yeah.
That we've got to really think through over long periods of time.
Yeah. You know, and we always see the errors of our ways way too late in life, right? Especially when you have, and I'll just go back in time to the buffalo. Right, we just slaughtered them, okay, and so we can now look back and go, okay, what we did was not good for the wildlife in North America. Hence, why we have the model of conservation that we have today. Now, being able to kind of look back at history and say, or look at Europe and say, dude, it's pay to play over there now. You can't, there's no public land over there. And so my question to you is, do you think there is a course correction that could or needs to be made to balance everything out to where it's not so lopsided anymore?
Oh, yeah. I think there absolutely something needs to be made, but it's just such a complex problem. Like, there's so many different things affect it. You just mentioned the buffalo, for example. That's another major issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, we have free ranging buffalo herds all over these states. Still, we still have all this native habitat that is essentially getting disturbed for free.
Yeah.
By herds of buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And see, we know a lot more about conservation in North American model now, but back then they just slaughtered them, like you said.
Yep.
If they had that mindset back then, they wouldn't have killed them all. They would have managed them in such a way that we manage our deer herds and things like that. I'm not saying that's like a great, perfect answer, but it's a hell of a lot better solution than killing them all the way that they did.
Right.
So if you have that, where you have this constant disturbance and you have all these native plants still present instead of just thousands of miles of fescue grass growing everywhere for pasture grass for cows,
mm-hmm.
you're talking about an insanely major shift in the amount of usable habitat on the landscape, not just for deer and buffalo, but for every other wild animal that's mm-hmm. out there.
Yeah.
So that's an issue in itself. You know, as far as the access is concerned, if we don't find a way to get more of it and to at bare minimum secure what we have currently,
mm-hmm.
then it's just going to continue to be more of a problem. Like, our kids are going to have to deal with it. Their kids, it's going to be even worse. And this is, people shrug it off, but it's something that really bothers me, because when you think about it, it was just a couple hundred years ago that all those buffalo got killed.
Yeah.
Like, that's not very long ago. Yeah. A lot of the communities that we live in were established in the mid to late 1800s, early 1900s. I mean, we're talking 100 years ago,
mm-hmm.
a little over that. That's not that long ago in the grand scheme of things.
Right.
And we've seen all these major changes occur just in deer hunting in 30 years. So what do you think is going to happen 30 years from now?
Yeah.
It's going to be more of the same unless we course correct, like what you're saying. Yeah. We have to have more access for people.
Yeah.
We've got to share more another with the fellow man. And I'm a big believer in habitat,
yeah.
Wildlife habitat and native wildlife habitat, and basically creating, securing, protecting as much of that as we possibly can.
All right. So I'm going to throw a hypothetical out here. Whose responsibility do you think that should be? Is that for the landowner to be responsible to provide access to other people? Or is that the state offering programs that allow landowners to benefit some way, shape, or form from allowing access, hunting access on their property.
The best way is probably for all the landowners to get on the same page and them do that independently than to involve the government.
Right.
But is that going to happen? Probably not, no. Because of the things we've already talked about. It's like, well, landowner A has worked their whole life to have this land. Landowner B has worked their whole life to have this land. And the price keeps going up. So it's like these people got to work even harder, got to sacrifice even more to get land.
Yeah.
Are they going to want to just – and that's the thing with the states. I mean, I love what a lot of the agencies do with – the habitat that they are in charge of.
Right.
They do. Most of them get a bad rap from the general public, but I've met a lot of the guys that work on these places that are just like me and you. Mm-hmm. They're just your average hunters. They make an average income every year, and that's all they care about doing is making wildlife habitat. I can't tell you how many of those guys I've met across the country that work for the State Department, and those guys are part of the government.
Yeah.
So I don't want to just, you know, crap on the government, but there's the majority, the wide-ranging majority of land is privately owned.
Yeah.
Like, unless you go out west.
Yeah.
But if we're talking whitetails and eastern turkeys, for example, I mean, I don't know, what is Iowa? Like,
less than
90-some two. Percent?
Yeah, it's less than 2% public. So it's 90, yeah. 98 or 99% private.
So then the question becomes, how is the state government even going to compete in the land, in the recreational land market?
Yeah.
So they can lease land, and I'm all, like, I support state land leasing projects like the walk-in areas and stuff that Iowa has and Kansas has. And Missouri's got some recreational, MRAP is what it's called.
Yep.
Recreational access programs. I'm all for those, but the problem is can the state compete with the land market that's out there? Because if a farmer can get more money for leasing it to a deer hunter or for just selling it outright for recreational hunting land to a private buyer, what's the incentive for them to get paid by the state to let everybody and their dog come on their land?
Yeah, man. So many things to think about, right? And it's like, I heard a really good clip from another podcast that's come out, and they're saying that because CRP is a federal program, to those who are enrolled in CRP programs, don't you think that, you know, we're paying you to plant certain types of vegetation on your property? Don't you think that that should also be access because it's a federal program for other people to enjoy your property? And so the guy that I heard, he pretty much said, then I just wouldn't put my farm in CRP anymore.
Right.
And so there goes, I'm guessing that person would still do the habitat work, but they would just not collect the money because they're looking for, everybody's looking for ways to, and any real estate land company is going to say, hey, here's this property for sale and here's how much money you can make off of it every year. Right, from the investment side of things. And so the second you take that out, if deer hunters or if the landowner wants to make money off it, they'll go to outfitting, they'll go to leasing, they'll go to some other way to make their money off of that property,
right,
other than a federal program.
Yeah, so that's what most of them are going to say.
Yeah,
you know, and like I said before, it's hard for me to blame them in their situation, but the only solution that I see, and I mean, I don't have all the answers, definitely. Mm-hmm. So don't take this as gospel or whatever. The only solution I see, and I'm plenty open to changing my mind on this, but if we need a shift in hunting culture, we need a shift in our culture, which is an extreme uphill battle, you know, but that's, basically, the way that we've gone in the last 30 years has shifted our culture to want and desire these things, which drive that price up, mm-hmm. which eliminate access. The positives of that is that one positive that I've seen goes back to the habitat thing. It's like more and more of these private landowners are getting educated about habitat conversion and all this stuff that's good for wildlife. And there are some government programs that actually pay them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like those are a win-win. The major disadvantage, though, is that they're creating habitat for one
mm-hmm.
person, you know, where, yeah, I mean, that's where I think if we shifted our culture a little bit away from that to sharing more, then we would be better off in the long run. And there's other things that the agencies or the governments can do that could help that.
Yeah.
And that opens up another total can of worms, which I'm sure you're probably fixing to ask here in a minute.
Well, whenever you say culture, the first thing that pops up is social media, right?
Yeah.
And so imagine, okay, we probably know a lot of the same people. So let's have this pretend conversation where Aaron Warburton goes up to a guy who manages his property for big bucks. And you're trying to explain to him that the greater good is to let people come and hunt your property. Somebody, not just, maybe it's nobody or it's somebody, right? Do you think that person or anybody would be open to saying, oh man, big bucks are awesome, but the future of hunting is, I mean, long story short, do you think enough people even care?
In the circles that you and I are in?
No.
Probably not.
No.
Probably not. But there's a lot of them that have a very different opinion about this than I have.
Yeah.
You know, and like I said, I don't know that I'm 100% right. I'm open to changing my mind about it, but I don't see that happening.
Yeah.
You know, and not just that, but if we got rid of scoring deer entirely, that might help.
Yeah.
Because then it doesn't put a number on things, but see, we went from scoring deer, then we went to aging deer.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's a number that we're all chasing.
Listen, aging deer to me is a mask term for people who want bigger antlers, because obviously the older a deer gets, right? And so the shift has been, I'm not really interested. And my dumb ass has said this before. I'm not really interested in big antler deer. I'm interested in older age class deer.
I think that's a cop out.
Yeah. I think that's a cop out.
But you know why we say that
mm-hmm.
is because we've grown up in this culture.
Right. Right.
And we've came about hunting that way. But that's why I have to rewire my brain sometimes. And whenever I talk to people about hunting, I always try to keep that perspective I had when I was 10 or 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's hard for me to do because like I said before, hunting mature bucks. But when I was 10 or 11 years old, it was just about the experience itself.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, these animals are freaking awesome. I know that I love hunting them. I know that I love the animal. You know, I want there to be more of them. And I want to, you know, have the excitement of the hunt.
Yeah.
And it wasn't any deeper than that. It didn't go into these levels of score and age and all that stuff. It was just solely based on the experience of that.
Yeah.
And then when we killed a deer, you know, you take it back to deer camp, and then, you know, your mentors, my dad, my uncles, show us how to cook deer meat over a fire or whatever. It's like, that's freaking awesome. And that is the stuff, that stuff right there has been around for thousands of years.
Yeah.
But the other things that we're talking about here have just come along.
Right.
Like in our culture. And that's why it's hard for you and I to even not talk about. Like if somebody calls me and asks me how big of a buck I saw was, I'm going to tell them based on the age or the score of the deer.
Yep.
Because that's what I've learned mm-hmm. to do over the last 20 some years.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a good thing long term.
Yeah. Man, imagine trying to break those habits. Like,
yeah.
Hey Dan, what'd you see tonight? I saw a buck. He had 10 points.
Yep. But that's what it was back in the 80s.
Yeah, I saw a 10-pointer.
Early 90s.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. And then so you kind of like, I always think about this. I've had a conversation. Well, I've tried to, and then it just didn't work out. I really want this conversation though. And I said in a podcast, I think that scoring deer is a problem, right? Well, I had someone from Boone and Crockett reach out to me who listens to the Nine Finger Chronicles and say, you're wrong, and here's why. And so I've never had the opportunity to follow up with that, but it's something that is on my goal, my piece of paper that I keep over here, to have that conversation, because I'm sure that Boone and Crockett was started for a good reason, but now,
but now
people use Boone and Crockett as a ranking system for how bad of a ass of a hunter I am.
Yeah, and there's a lot of good people that work there too. And like, if somebody hears that works there, they immediately feel like defensive about it,
right?
Because that's who, you know, that's their livelihood or that's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that they're a bad person. It doesn't mean that we're bad people for talking about it necessarily. Yeah. But that's why it takes difficult conversations.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know that I have all the answers, but. And at the time, you just alluded to it, you don't know what you're doing at that moment in time. You're trying to, a lot of people that go down these roads, they're doing it for a genuine good reason at the time.
Right.
And nobody has a crystal ball to see what the hell is going to happen in 20 or 30 years.
Right.
So it's easy to sit back and armchair quarterback and blame people for doing things 20 and 30 years ago. But like, I look at the Realtree Monster Bucks videos, for example, when they started coming out with the deer score on their videos, like every deer that was killed, they showed the score.
Mm-hmm.
We thought that was the coolest thing ever.
Absolutely.
We're like, that's never been done before. Right. Nobody's ever, like, they're making a video about these huge bucks, and now you can actually see what the deer measures and all that.
Yeah.
And they weren't doing that to try to ruin the future of hunting. That's ridiculous.
Right.
They're not. I mean, I know those guys.
Yeah.
Most of them are great people.
Yeah.
So, like I said, it's not their fault. It's the progression that we've taken.
Yeah.
And I think it's important that we're all aware of that and how we got here.
Yeah.
But if you stick to the basic fundamentals of why we hunt, the basic principles, they've always been there.
Yeah.
They never have changed.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they're still there, even in the guys that are hardcore trophy hunters, that are huge land managers, like what you're saying. I've had long conversations with them and got their stories about, you know, where they came from and how they got their start in hunting. We're all pretty similar.
Yep. Yeah,
and they hunt because a deer shows up and their heart gets to pounding, and they like to eat deer meat, and they like to spend time with their friends and their family in the woods. It's like all these things are the same. And I think that's where, if we focus our hunting culture on those things and not the negative side, then all of a sudden we all have this common thread. We all have this common ground that we can come back to.
Yeah, yeah. I gotta talk about trail cameras for a second, because,
dude, I knew that's what I said. I was like, crossbows and trail cameras are coming up, and we're gonna have to get into that.
I'm not as terribly concerned in this conversation about weapons per se, because I do feel that access is it trumps that. Okay.
Yep.
But what I will talk about trail cameras is my own experience. And the first trail camera that I ever had, right, these big Moultries with the huge C batteries in them. I mean, they weighed like about what a VCR would weigh. And then the funny part was, when you would get those trail cameras, they came with two mini bungee cords. And if the tree wasn't the right size, you either had to wrap them around a couple times, or it would sag on the tree. And you had to find creative ways to tighten that up. Anyway. The whole point of this conversation now is like, I changed when I got my first trail camera. And do you know why I changed? It's because I got to see everything that I couldn't see anymore. And my goals changed once I got trail cameras. And that, my friends, is when I started hunting older age class, bigger antlered deer. Is when I, because I'm trying to think of life before that, dude, anything that walked by, I was trying to shoot, and I didn't do a very good job at it. The first buck I ever shot came, first deer I ever shot with a bow. I think it was a doe. Yeah, I shot a doe first, and then I shot a buck came by, and I was like, okay, well, that's a small buck, like a really small buck. But here's a doe, shot the doe, right? And now I feel like trail cameras have changed me so much that I don't even want to shoot does anymore, because I feel that if I shoot a doe, I'm going to ruin, or that buck is going to see me, and I'm going to get busted by this buck, and then he's gone for a period of time. And so I feel that the biggest impact in any type of technology advancement has been the trail camera. That to me has, not only for me, but I feel has had the biggest cultural impact on hunting in North America.
My day kicks off with a refreshing Celsius energy drink, then straight to the gym. Pre-K pickup, back home to meal prep. Time for my fire station shift. One more Celsius, gotta keep the lights on. When the 3-alarm hits, I'm ready. Celsius, live, fit, go. Grab a cold, refreshing Celsius at your local retailer or locate now at Celsius.com.
Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands you need. From athletic stuff, like a full court pickup game, swish, to athletic-ish stuff, like a half mile stroll. Get those steps in! And for morning hikes up the mountain trail, good pace to nighttime ghost stories from the camping chair. What a twist! Whatever level of active, Sierra loves it all. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athletic-ish, Sierra's got it.
What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. 100%. And, like, it's gotten to the point now with these cell cameras where, I mean, most adults know that these cell phones here, they're programmed to addict you.
Mm-hmm.
Social media is programmed to addict you to it.
Yes.
Now you have a cellular trail camera that's connected to your cell phone that you already, the majority of us, if we're being honest with ourselves, already are addicted to these damn things.
Yep.
Now we have pictures of our trail camera giving us notifications at all hours of the night and hours of the day. And we're so much connected to our technology that's out there that it's just this direction is not good.
Right.
It isn't, but it's not just the cellular trail camera. It's also the cell phone. It's also the social media algorithms and the artificial intelligence. And, you know, you go down the damn rabbit hole with all that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, when cameras, like you said, you didn't know where that big buck was. Mm-hmm. You didn't know if the big buck was even there. Because how many times do you actually lay eyes on them in a given year?
Right.
You know, most of the time it ain't very much. No. If they're really big one, you might be able to catch some sign or a track or something here. But now that you actually have an image of them, I bet you anymore, the majority of the big, like, 5-year-old bucks that are killed, the majority of them have walked in front of a trail camera.
Oh, yeah.
And probably multiple trail cameras by multiple hunters.
Right.
Like, I've noticed that about hunting public land. If there's a really big deer using that public land, people come out of the woodwork because they all know about him.
Mm-hmm.
Because they all have pictures of him in those woods.
Right.
And with the cell cams, it's been, you know, before I saw a lot of trail cameras on public land, but since the cell cams became affordable, not a couple years ago when they were expensive, but just in the last 2 years when they've become affordable, there are cell cameras all over public land.
They're all over, period.
They're all over period, because people don't have to go to check them.
Mm-mm.
all they have to do is put lithium batteries in it. And if they purchase a good one that's got good battery life, they can go. And I mean, why wouldn't you do this if you're wanting to be successful? This is a great way to be successful. Mm-hmm. Take your camera and put it in that secure location, and you don't have to go back there to check it.
Yeah,
that's what kept me from putting cameras in bedding areas before was, well, I can't walk in there every 2 weeks or I'm going to spook everything out of it.
Man, such
now a good you
point.
Can put it right there and it just sits there all fall and tells you what's coming and going.
Yeah. Here's a dilemma that I ran into. Well, it was a dilemma until I actually did it. Okay. And so I have on one of my farms, there's two pinch points. And I got a couple tree stands set up in this one pinch point that, I mean, it's money, okay? Well, and the other pinch point, I have a cell camera. And I have some cell cameras. And I got a ping while I'm in the tree stand. So, of course, I look at my phone, and it's a buck. He's a good buck, but he's not a shooter, all right? He's a three-year-old. This is private ground. I know what else is running around there. So I said to myself, okay, I'm going to rattle and I'm going to see if this buck, who I haven't even seen yet, just trail camera pictures of him, comes in. Put the horns together and he came within shooting range. And I felt gross. Me personally, I felt like, would I have rattled if that buck didn't show up on trail camera to, you know, have him come in? No, probably not. I just would have sat there. So now, it's like, I love having trail cameras because I am an hour and a half to 3 hours away from some of my farms. And when I'm in the tree stand and I get pictures of them, I'm just like, God, I haven't had this happen yet, but a shooter walk in front of a trail camera, rattle, grunt, blind grunt, and they come in and you shoot them based off of information that's 500 yards away that you would have never seen anyway. And there's examples of that on the internet, right? Oh, I got a cell cam. Let's run down to the bottom of the hill, got the rifle, boom, shot him, dead deer, you know, 15 minute period. And so for me, I think that's ugly. I hope that never happens to me. I hope I'm never in the dilemma where I have to be put to that test, but I feel like it's inevitable given the given the technology that we use.
I mean, just think about, look, I talked to a lot of those, you were talking about industry personalities a while ago and the different guys that own big land and stuff. I've talked to them personally about how their hunting strategies have changed in the last 2 decades.
Yeah.
You know, they used to hunt out of tree stands, heavy tree stands that were not easy to move around. They weren't mobile. They had to pack them back deep into the woods and set up based on sign. Now they are sitting on food plots in very expensive box blinds that are designed to contain your scent, where there is a device in front of them that is texting them the daily occurrences of that food plot. You know, and they have these various properties, and they wait until they get a buck that's big enough or old enough or whatever the criteria is on that camera at that food plot, and they systematically go in there and kill those deer over those spots. And that's all that number one, that is them accruing that much knowledge over the years. So I'm not going to take that away from anybody, but it's also because of our advances in technology.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all things, we got to remember this in the grand scheme of things. This is all stuff that has just happened.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this is stuff that the world population is just dealing with now, on especially at this rampant pace that we're at with technology. We're just dealing with this in the last few decades.
Yeah. Do you feel that technology and culture then changes the definition of what hunting actually is?
I don't know that it, like I said, the positive thing is that we still have our innate similarities to why we hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Like most people I talk to, no matter where they're from or what style they like to hunt, They all share those common things. And the heck, the Indians thousands of years ago had those same common things. Like I have hope for that to continue.
Yeah.
As long as we continue to talk about it, that's, and to show it in content, and I think that's kind of in our DNA as human beings almost.
Yeah.
But the other aspect of it, I definitely worry about, because I mean, we've already discussed in this podcast of all the different ways that we've individually got off track away from that over the years.
Yeah.
And I'm aware that it's there, and I'm still, pulled in that direction, because I use cameras. I mean, I love checking trail camera. Like, I'm addicted to this dang phone and waking up in the morning and looking at the trail camera pictures on it.
Right.
But I don't know that that's a good thing for our brains.
Right.
You know, and the more stuff that you add to this, the easier hunting becomes.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking initially about how we're trying to make things challenging for our kids to get them involved in hunting. But then we, as we get older and more experienced, are trying to make things easier.
Yeah.
By adopting all these technologies. It's like, well, maybe it ain't such a bad thing to make hunting hard again to some degree.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about going back to making your own stick bow out of the woods behind your house, but there's got to be a little bit of give and take there.
Yeah, man. Because obviously with the introduction of trail cameras, with the introduction of high speed crossbows, just rifling in general, bullets, ammunition, anything, right? Any weapon.
Dude, Jake's got a muzzleloader now that will kill a deer at like 1,000 yards. It is freaking insane.
I mean, nuts.
I think it's really cool, but I'm also kind of worried about it.
Yeah.
You know,
man.
I mean, we went from having a muzzleloader with a cap and ball that you'd be lucky to kill something at 50 yards with, and now we're looking at a high-powered rifle, essentially.
Yeah. Man. All right, so we've talked a lot about these almost negative things, right? All the bad things that have changed the culture, that have changed the way we define hunting. What's a couple things that may be a silver lining or a positive ending to this conversation?
Well, social media gets a lot of criticism for good reason on a lot of things. But one thing it does give us the opportunity to do is to talk to young people.
Yeah.
And to engage with young people, which, you know, as hunter numbers were dropping off for a lot of these agencies, you know, in the 2000s and whatnot, they didn't have access to that as much. I mean, when I was a kid growing up, I watched the Outdoor Channel and TNN Outdoors and things like that. But now we have the ability to put our hunting culture in front of a lot of young people.
Right.
And I'm not so much worried about turning them into hunters as I am them understanding what hunting is.
Yes.
And why we do it. And I feel like if the message of conservation, if the message of why we hunt, those innate things that we talked about a while ago, just the basic principles we can all agree on, if those messages are permeated through social media and reach a lot of the population that we wouldn't have been able to reach in the last generation, that could be a positive thing.
Yeah. And then also do that without getting in our own way.
Yeah.
And I say that because I feel that the biggest enemy of hunters are hunters in a certain way, like the infighting that happens, like us. Like, you can't even post a picture of an antler that you found, let's say shed hunting. You can't even post a picture of it without someone saying, what game farm did you get that from? Or, you know, like, oh, yeah, that's a great deer, but you shot it with this. Man.
Yeah, dude, people are going to listen to this podcast, and they're going to hate some of the things that I said.
Yep.
I mean, there's going to be hunters that hear the stuff that I said and that completely disagree with me.
Right.
But what I want you to focus on, if you take nothing away from this whole conversation, is like, we are likely the same in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Look for the similarities.
We're likely, yes, we have all these innate similarities. And if we stay on that, if we stay focused on that, and we talk about those things, and we show those things, then that becomes more ingrained in our culture. And it seems like that would be an easy thing to do because we all share those similarities, but we all seem, instead of focusing on those similarities, we all want to pick at the difference.
Yeah.
You know, and then fight over that difference, whatever that is.
Yeah.
Like you said, the game farm and the shed antler thing. Like, why are you out there doing that in the very first place? Like, what is the reason you're doing that?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah. That's a great point. It just, I feel like I'm continuing to become a hypocrite in my thoughts towards hunting because, you know, in the past I've voiced my opinions on crossbows, but at the same time, I don't want to limit somebody who only shoots a crossbow. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's times and places for everything, and which, long story short, I continue to reevaluate my thought on certain things almost on the daily, right? And so it's an ever-changing internal conversation that I have of is my thought process right? Like, am I making a decision on a certain topic based off of my own selfishness, or is it for the greater good of hunting? And that to me is ever changing.
Oh yeah, I'm in the same boat, 100%.
Yeah,
and yeah, the crossbow thing is I totally agree on that.
Yeah. So, well, man, we've been at it for a while now, and I feel like this was an excellent conversation, a great way to kick off 2024. I appreciate you taking time out of your day to do this, man, and good luck the rest of the season, whatever's left of it.
Thanks, man. No problem at all. Happy to do it.
And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, another episode in the books. Huge shout out to Aaron. Huge shout out to all of you for taking time out of your day to download and listen to the Nine Finger Chronicles. Huge shout out to Tethered, Wasp, Vortex, Code Blue, Woodman's Pal, Huntworth, and of course, Full Sneak Gear. Please go out and support the companies that support this podcast. And last but not least, good vibes, man. Be kind to each other and have a good day. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.